Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Gordon Vanderspew, and we'll be answering your questions on the feather mechanic. The show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Gordon a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show today. And while you're there, make sure that you sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill out the form on the right side of our homepage, and we'll let you know when the next live show will be. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within about 48 hours after the show ends. You can also find it on any of the podcast sites like Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website or any of the podcast platforms at your convenience and listen to the recording at any time. If you're out and about on Facebook, Instagram, or X, we'd sure appreciate it if you'd share our podcast. And when you do, use the hashtag AskAboutFlyFishing and hashtag FlyFishing. In fact, if you have a moment, do it right now while you're listening to the show. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted as the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. When we return, we'll be talking with Gordon about the feather mechanic. Enrico Puglisi flies pride themselves with creating unique and one-of-a-kind flies and fly tying material. Enrico has been experimenting with durable synthetic and natural materials to create flies that catch fish for more than 30 years. His innovative products include brushes, fibers, and components that have made a major impact on the direction of saltwater fly fishing, and his methods and materials are respected worldwide. Whether you want your flies hand-tied for you or you'd like to tie your own, be sure to visit Enrico Puglisi Flies and browse through their online catalog. Visit epflies.com and do a little shopping today. Again, that's epflies.com. Before we introduce Gordon, we'd like to let you know about the great prizes we have to give away tonight. For our drawing tonight, we'll be giving away a one-year membership to Fly Fishers International and a one-year membership to Trout Unlimited. Now, if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage, which is at askaboutflyfishing.com, and look for the link under Gordon's section that says Register for our free drawing. Click on that link and fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a copy of Gordon's book, The Feather Mechanic. Now, here's how you can win. You must be the first person to answer the question we ask at the end of the show. The question will be about something that Gordon and I have talked about during the show. And you submit your answer along with your name and location using the text box on our homepage. And that's the same text box you can ask questions in during the show. So listen closely, take notes, pay attention, and maybe you'll be the lucky winner of the feather mechanic. So hang tight and be attentive. Our guest tonight is Gordon Vanderspew. Gordon, also known as the feather mechanic, is an actor, author, podcaster, fly tire, and fly fisher from South Africa. Art has always been a way of life for him and has helped him communicate better with the world around him. Pictures have a way of explaining things like few other things can. So when Gordon wrote his first book, Feather Mechanic, A Fly Tying Philosophy, he illustrated it too. As a young boy, he found inspiration in the likes of Dave Whitlock, Oliver Edwards, Charles Jardine, and South Africa's own Tom Sutcliffe. These artists had a big influence on Gordon, who all had a hand in shaping the way he worked. The premise behind his book is that to tie effective and efficient flies, one has to allow the form to follow function, figure out what you need the pattern to do, and then tie it to fulfill that purpose. Call it purpose-driven fly tying as opposed to just tying by the numbers, as it were. Tying by the numbers will always be limited. The path to fly tying enlightenment, it seems, lies in understanding the logic behind and what makes effective flies effective. In essence, Gordon's whole approach seeks to find the logic in everything he does. Gordon, welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Thank you, Roger. Thanks.
Thanks for staying up so late in South Africa. I know it's late there, and this is an odd thing for us to be doing this in the middle of the afternoon here, but we do what we need to do to get things to work. So, again, thank you so much for going out of your way.
It's just a pleasure.
Okay. So let's just start with what inspired you to write The Feather Mechanic. in the first place?
Well, okay, so I was on a Facebook group and someone asked me a question, and the easiest way I could explain it to the guy was to draw a picture. So I drew a small little diagram and I said, your problem is that, and that's how you solve it. And then after that, someone else asked me a question and they said, hey, I'm having trouble with this. What do I need to do? And I drew another picture. And after about a week of doing this, various people asking me to draw pictures and explain things, someone said to me, why don't you write a book? You know, why don't you do it? I'm loving these little drawings and I'm loving your explanations, and they're explaining things in a very effective way and efficient way and a way that's easy to understand. And if you did this, I'd buy a book. And I thought, okay. And I told my wife on the Sunday, I said, I'm going to write a book. And I put it on Facebook and I told people, I'm writing a book. If anyone wants to order one, you can start ordering it. I can't tell you when it's going to be done, but yeah, I'm writing this book. And 2 years later, I finished the book.
And I can imagine all the, after reading through it, you know, all the illustrations must have taken an enormous amount of time, much less the writing, of course.
Well, the illustrations take way longer than the actual writing. Each drawing takes about anything from an hour to 3 hours to draw. And
wow.
If you think of that first book there, I think there's something like 217 drawings in that book.
Do the math, right? No wonder it's 2 years.
It's years. Yeah, it's years. You basically draw for a year. You just draw for all year.
Yeah. Well, seems like you enjoy it. Is that, just out of curiosity, do you draw those larger and then shrink them down for the book? Is that how it's done?
Well, I do draw them larger, and then, yeah, we do shrink them down. You just get a crisper image if you do that. It's just cleaner. Mm-hmm. And also in the way of we reproduce the images, we've learned a lot over the years. In the beginning, we used to scan the images, okay? Mm-hmm. But later on, we learned that that's not the best way to do it. The best way is to photograph the images and then edit them from there.
Ah.
And in that way, you get a clearer image. Because if you want to scan an image properly, you've got to use like a drum scanner, like an industrial drum scanner, and it's very expensive. And I'm an actor by trade, and I self-publish. So I had to find a way to get a good quality image, but in a way that didn't break the bank either. And the best way to do that was through photographs.
And then you could use Photoshop or whatever to clean them up and if needed and, yeah, so forth. That makes sense. I was going to ask you how you got started in fly fishing and fly tying. Was that early on in your life?
So it's quite interesting. I got sent to a choir school when I was 13 years old, okay? And there's a choir school in a mountain range in South Africa called the Drakensberg, and it's the Drakensberg Boys Choir School. And the first day that I arrived there, I saw a boy standing.
Gordon, I've lost you. I don't know if you can hear me, but I can't hear you anymore. I'm trying to get him back on now, so, okay, maybe this is him here.
Roger, can you hear me? Oh,
yes, now I can. Yeah, we lost you there for a while. You left off, you had said you were talking about going to the boys' school is where you lost you.
I went to this choir school in the mountains, and on the first day there, I saw a guy practicing his casting, and I asked him if he could teach me, and that's basically where I started. You know, when I saw this guy casting, I just knew that's something I wanted to do. I didn't even know what he was doing. But I just knew it looked cool. So that's where fishing started for me.
And was that fishing or was that fly fishing? That
was fly fishing. That's why I always tell people, I don't think you choose fishing. I think fly fishing chooses you. You know, mm-hmm. You see it and it just, something clicks. And you just know you have to do it.
Yeah, that was kind of the way with me too. I think I was about 13. I had fished with my dad, but a neighbor 2 doors down was taught us how to tie flies, and so we had our little local mentor as well. So, and did you start tying flies then as well as fishing?
Well, about a year later, I started tying flies, and I didn't know anything about fly tying. So I didn't even know that you tied flies with a vise. So I just tied flies in the way I thought they should be tied. And I got some sewing thread from my mother. I cut some hair off the dog, and I had an old little carp hook, and I tried to tie this fly. And I tied it. I named it after the dog. I called it Goldie's Nymph. And it was terrible. It was a really bad fly. But I caught a fish on it. No, it was terrible. It was crap. But I caught a fish on it, so it was cool.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, that's what counts in the end, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so, and then how did you progress from there? How did you, were you self-taught all the way? Did you have a mentor of sorts?
Well, eventually I started pissing everyone off in my house because I'd cut up my mom's pantyhose and I'd cut up her pearl necklace and I'd cut my sister's Barbie doll's hair and I'd cut the dog and I was a terrorist. I was like a fly tying terrorist, okay. And eventually my family sat me down and they said, okay, we've got an ultimatum for you. If we buy you a proper fly tying kit and proper fly tying materials, will you stop harassing everything in the house? So I said, fine, if you can do that, I'll stop harassing the things in the house. And yeah, I got a decent fly tying kit. And along with this kit, I got a book called The Basic Manual of Fly Tying by Pattebra and Fling. Are you still there?
Yep, I'm listening. We're listening.
Okay, by Pattebra and Fling. And this book had drawings in it. And they were extremely, they weren't great drawings, but they were extremely clear in terms of the intention and what you had to do. Like a basic willy bugger had something like 36 steps in it, you know. So it was very clear and it was very logical. And so I taught myself using this book, The Basic Manual of Fly Tying. And it basically progressed from there, you know. And I'd obviously follow magazines and I'd read books and I'd whatever I could get my hands on. I'd do that. But the light bulb or my Damascus moment, if you can call it that, happened in an art class one day where we were learning about the Bauhaus movement. And it's basically, the Bauhaus was a school of architecture in the Netherlands. And they were, our teacher was teaching us about a guy named, what was this guy's name? The guy who invented the skyscraper. And he had this whole philosophy that form follows function. So basically figure out what you need something to do and then build it to do that. And the minute he said that, I realized that, you know, you could do this with fly tying.
Right.
I've been following patterns, but that was like tying by numbers in a way, you know, just following mm-hmm. steps shown to me. I'd never really thought about why I was doing what I was doing, you know? And then I started deconstructing it, asking myself, what does this fly need to do? Does it need to float? Does it need to sink? Does it need to, what must it do, you know? And then I would construct it to do that. And that changed the whole way I tied flies. I mean, a lot of people right. just tie by numbers. They follow videos, they follow steps, they follow, but they don't often have a full understanding of what they're doing.
Yeah. I mean, I look back at some of the old tying books that I have, which go back many, many, many years. But many times that was just the recipe. You know, there were no instructions. It was like this hook, that dubbing, this. And they showed a picture, and then you had to figure out what to do with the recipe. But there were no real instructions. And many cooking recipes are still like that nowadays where they don't particularly tell what, you know, the technique is at a certain step. And that's where you picked up, though, right? I mean, that's your instructions detail, and I'm hoping we get into that here a little bit, the actual whys and wherefores, so to speak, at each step. I think that's where, I think you talked about it in your book, and you called it a thinking fly tire, right? I think that was a word you used or a phrase you used. Gordon, are you there?
I'm there. I'm here. I'm here. Can you
Okay.
hear me?
Lost you again. Yeah, I lost you again. Weird. Are you reconnecting when you come back in, or are you just sitting there?
Every time I'm reconnecting.
Okay, just so I know, because I'm dropping your previous connection, and then you seem to appear, so good. Yeah, what I was saying is, when I was reading the book, you referred to the thinking fly tire, and when you're talking about form follows function and deciding, you know, what it's to do, then and then you design it, how does one become a thinking fly tire? I mean, what tips can you give people to move away from that recipe kind of approach?
Well, the first thing you need to understand is you need a knowledge, a working knowledge of the environment you're fishing in. If you know nothing about trout and the environment and what they feed on and why they feed on those things and when they feed on them, you're never going to be able to be an effective and optimal fly tire. So the first thing you need to do is become a student of nature. You have to do that. So that's the first step to being a good fly tire, is to understand your quarry and understand the thing, yeah, and basically understand the environment, yeah.
Yeah, it's, I think a lot of people don't, yes. A lot of people don't take that approach, though. I think they're just, in many cases, you know, because there's so many flies out there. And nowadays, it wasn't this way when I started, but, you know, the videos of how to tie things, which I think are much better for people to learn. But getting out in nature and capturing the bugs and so forth, I know you did that with the damsel flies that you talked about in your book, and I want to talk more about that particular fly. But tell us a bit about what you observed before you started tying your skinny damsel fly.
Well, okay, so the first thing I observed, if you look in the water and you actually look at the bugs that fish feed on, the first thing you realize is that a lot of these bugs don't move about as often as you would think they do. A lot of the time, these bugs are just sitting there. As a kid, when I was at that choir school, for instance, dragonfly nymphs would sit in the river and burrow in the riverbed, and they would just sit there. You know, and they'd spend a lot of time not moving at all. And if you look at a dragonfly nymph and you study it, you'll realize it's got an underslung jaw, number one. It's articulated. So the way it feeds is it literally, it's an ambush predator. It waits for things to come within range, and then like a chameleon, it zaps them with its jaw. So most people who fish dragonfly nymphs move them the whole time. But very often, dragonfly nymphs are static. They don't move that much. So you would then tie a fly and fish that fly static, because that's what the naturals do. The answers are all around us. You know, you can read books, and books are great. But books will never be a substitute for experience. I mean, Frank Sawyer, let's look at Sawyer, right? So Sawyer was fishing on these chalk streams, and the way you had to fish these chalk streams was with dry flies. And one day his red pheasant spinner starts sinking, and he's still taking fish on it. In fact, he's taking more fish on it. And he thinks to himself, wow, there's something here. And he designs the pheasant tail nymph, which basically was the mother of all modern nymphs. I mean, if you think about it, when did he tie this pheasant tail nymph? In 1956, I think. And it's all these years later, and we're still fishing them, you know. And that was basically just because of observation. He realized fish feed subsurface most of the time. So take your fly to them. And, you know, and that was the breakthrough.
Right, right. I think back then when he was doing that, it was required that you fished dry flies, wasn't it? Something like that, something crazy, like nobody was...
No, you had to.
Yeah, it was...
The rules were that you had to fish a dry fly. But, yeah, so the rules were that. But then logic sort of challenged the rules. He looked at them and he went, but this doesn't make any sense. You know, fish are feeding subsurface more than they are on the surface. These rules don't make sense.
How do you, when you're thinking about a new pattern, what's your logic? What's your approach to creating a new pattern?
So I don't care about the pattern. I care about what it's got to do. I'll give an example. So a friend of mine catches sand sharks on fly. A sand shark, some people call them guitar fish. It's basically...
Oh, yeah.
Do you know what a guitar fish is?
Yes, yes. So
he's catching these things on the flats, and he realizes that because this thing's got an underslung mouth or a mouth underneath its sort of body, it hovers on top of the fly, tastes the fly. So what you'd need is you need a fly that rides with the hook point up, because if you don't do that, you'll never hook the fish. So what he then did was he used bath chain, tied very much like a Clausen minnow, but with two sort of balls or bath chains on each side. And that acts as a sort of stabilizer. So the fly can't tip over, because it's very important that a hook point rides up, because if you don't do that, the fish isn't going to get hooked. The second thing is you need to see the fly. So the material you tie it with generally will be chartreuse or white or any visible color. It doesn't matter, but it's just got to be visible. Because the minute the fish swims over the fly, you don't see the fly anymore. And then you slowly tighten, and then you feel the pressure, and then you just strip strike and you're in. So the whole fly is tied to be fished in a certain way and for that specific species. So that's how fly design works. You have these problems and you try and figure them out or solve them through tying. Yeah.
Right, right. Gordon, we need to take a quick break here, but when we come back, I'd like to talk about, you know, the process that you might go through for testing design. So hang tight. I'll be right back.
Okay.
The Ugly Bug Fly Shop in Casper, Wyoming has been serving fly fishers in Wyoming and around the world since 1983. Their selection of top-of-the-line gear and a huge assortment of flies is one of the best in the land. All products are available in their fly shop and online. Looking for advice? Just give them a call, and their expert professional staff will help you with whatever you need. Visit the Ugly Bug Fly Shop today at uglybugflyshop.com, or you can call them at 866-845-9284. Again, it's the uglybugflyshop.com, or call them at 866-845-9284. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Gordon Vanderspew about the feather mechanic. If you'd like to ask Gordon a question, just go to our homepage, askaboutflyfishing.com. Use that Q&A text box to send us your question. Okay, Gordon, so do you go through a testing process when you have a new pattern? Is it kind of a trial, so to speak, of the pattern and then adjust from there?
All the time. All the time. So you come up with something, you have a problem that you need to sort out to, and you've got to figure out a fishing solution to it, and you tie the fly and you tweak it. You fish it and you tweak it the whole time until it functions in the perfect, perfect way. The main thing about a fly is that it needs to present optimally. So if your fly is twisting your tippet, that's a problem, because you're going to have a twisted tippet. So then you're going to need to go back to the drawing board and ask yourself, well, why? Why is this thing twisting the tippet? What's the problem here? And you basically logically work out what the problem is. And you adjust or adapt the fly the whole time. And eventually you've got something that works optimally, that is a fantastic tool. Yeah.
Yeah, I think in your description of tying the skinny damsel, you're talking about making sure that tail is on the top of the shank. Otherwise, if it's not perfectly on top, then that would potentially twist the fly. It wouldn't ride right or whatever. So something as simple as that could be wrecking, basically, the performance of the fly, right?
Exactly. So there's, in fly tying, there's something called the domino effect. And fly tying steps are like stacked up dominoes that get toppled over. But if you get something wrong, it affects you later on. It has a compounding effect. So, for instance, the tail of a woolly bugger. If you tie the tail of the woolly bugger on the side of the hook shank, your woolly bugger will never, ever move optimally. It has to be tied on top of the hook shank, okay, to ensure that it's balanced and that it moves properly. You can, if you tie the tail incorrectly, it doesn't matter how well you tie the rest of the fly will fail as a tool because the tail isn't working optimally. So you've got to nail every single step of the fly and make sure that everything's working properly. And that's the important thing.
It's like when you talk about the domino effect and reading your instructions on tying, I noticed that you did address that domino effect and say, hey, you know, if you don't do it right, back up, you know, or take it off the hook and start over until you get it right. Because that domino effect, and I know I've done this, I'm guilty of this, is, oh, I think I'll put a couple more wraps on there just to make sure, right? Just to make sure, which really I didn't need and which added to the bulk of the fly. And that's where if you keep doing that, you get this potentially chubby little fly coming off the vise. But that's what you're referring to as well. Yep.
Exactly. Look at dam. Okay, so there's another thing in fly tying that's very important. And that's called thread control. When you are working with thread, it is doing things while you're working with it. So most threads are twisted in a clockwise direction. By working with your thread flat, you use less thread, okay? So you keep the bulk down. Every time you wrap your thread, you introduce twist into it. So what you have to do is counter twist the thread while you're tying with it to ensure it keeps on coming in flat. So the one thing about especially damselfly nymphs are extremely delicate, but most damselfly nymphs you see, like especially commercially tied versions, are way too bulky. They're way too fat. You know, a damselfly is a delicate thing. So a small thing like thread control has a massive impact on your fly.
Let's dig into that damsel, that skinny damsel fly. It's the first fly in your first book that you break down. And what I'd like to do is that we already talked about some of the research you did of observing those damsel and dragonflies and so forth. Can you kind of walk us through the steps of tying this fly and talk about the importance of each one of those steps as you go through?
Okay, so the first thing I do with this fly, I start the thread from the back of the fly, and I use what Wayne Llewellyn calls a reverse jam hitch, okay? And I lay a flat thread base from the back of the shank all the way to about just past the middle of the hook shank, okay? From there, I will tie in a clump of marabou for the tail. I use a pin strap. I'll wet the ends of the marabou. I'll twist them with the forefinger and thumb of my right hand, and then I'll cut them off. And that's just to make sure that it's easy to tie in. I'll tie them in with a pin strap on top of the hook shank. What I'll then do is I'll tie in a length of very thin copper wire in the exact same spot, but on the far side of the hook shank. And what I'll then do is I will tie the rib and the tail in at the same time, moving my thread back towards the back of the shank. Now, why do I do that? Why am I tying the rib and the tail in at the same time? To minimize thread. Because if I tie the tail in, that's one layer of thread. there, one layer coming back, then I tie the ribbon, that's another layer, that, and coming back, another layer. So just by doing simple things like that, you minimize bulk. The next thing I do is at the tail, I tie in some marabou barbs for the body. Not many, normally about 4. It's very delicate, so you've got to work carefully. And I will use what I call a wrap and trap to basically wrap them forward. So I'll wrap with my right hand, trap the barbs with the pad of my index finger of my left hand, and then I'll gather the barbs up again and wrap. So it's wrap, trap, wrap, trap, wrap, trap, until I get to more or less about halfway the length of the hook shank. And then I'll tie them in. And then I'll rib using a cross rib. Can you still hear me?
Yes, yes.
Okay, I'll use a cross rib, and I'll rib, wrapping my ribs towards me at a slight angle. So it's in the opposite direction to the way I wrap the body of the fly. And what that does is it protects those barbs. So if a trout's teeth hit them, they won't unravel because they're trapped by copper wire. So that's the goal of the copper wire, is to make the fly more durable, number one, but also to provide a bit of contrast. I'll typically use chartreuse copper wire or blue copper wire or red copper wire or, you know, something like that. So there's a little bit of contrast in the fly. And contrast is quite an important thing, I think, in a fly pattern, because what it does is it basically draws the fish's attention to the fly. You know, if you've got contrasting colors in a pattern, that's why a lot of flies nowadays have hot spots. It's got to do with contrast.
And you also, in your book, talked about laying a base of white thread to begin with, and marking it, but also the color, like you were just talking about contrast, how what thread you might put over that white would show up better, its natural color, than going, for instance, darker or whatever. And I can see that working with the contrast that you're talking about.
Yeah, so you use a lighter colored thread for two reasons. When you wrap materials over a lighter colored thread, when they get wet, they remain true to color. If the thread was darker, they would come out darker, okay? That's the first reason. The second reason is you can make markings on a light thread underbody. So you can basically mark where all the elements of the fly needs to be with a little fine liner, you know, like a little pen. You can mark it out. That's something I learned from classic fly tying. You know, we do that all the time. So, yeah, so small things like that. I mean, if you're battling with proportions, lay a thread foundation, mark out where everything needs to be. You know, like a stupid thing. Like beginners typically overcrowd the eye of the hook because they don't plan ahead, and then they get to the end, and then they've got all this bulk, thread bulk happening there. But imagine if a millimeter or two behind that hook eye, you made a mark, and you call that no man's land, and you said to yourself, I'm never allowed passing this. You know, when I tie the thorax down or whatever, I tie off there and I cut the material off, I'm not allowed passing that mark. If you did that, you would never, ever crowd the hook eye.
Simple. Right. Yeah. Yeah. When you put it that way, it's planning it out from the beginning. And because I know that when I was tying, you know, early on, and I still do it. But I'll crowd that eye because I don't make those marks or don't land that fly. And a lot of times it's because you don't tie that fly a lot. You know, it's maybe the first time. But all the more reason to make a plan, right?
But you've just actually highlighted a very important point. You know, when you tie a specific fly, it's actually always prudent to not just tie one, tie 12. You know, sit down for 3-4 hours, tie 12. And with every single one you tie, ask yourself what you would do to improve it, and then incorporate those observations in the next fly. And if you do that the whole time, you will incrementally improve as you go. So yeah.
Right. Yeah. Well, continue on with the skinny damsel. I think you were at the point of maybe tying in the
Thorac, wing case.
this ring case, right? Ring case with this, yeah, the straw. Yeah.
Okay, I use Swiss straw for the wing case. And the reason I like Swiss straw, I mean, a lot of patterns don't use Swiss straw anymore, and I don't understand why, because it's great stuff. What Swiss straw does is, when it gets wet, it's actually translucent. It's see-through. So when you use like a lighter Swiss straw and you dab a darker body, it actually shines through the wing case, which is quite a natural thing, you know. Nymphs are translucent, especially when they are hatching or on their way to hatch. You get subcutaneous gases trapped underneath the nymphal skin, and it gives them this look of translucency. So translucency is another trigger in a pattern. In the same way as contrast is a trigger, translucency as well. So I'll use a little bit of a UV dubbing for the thorax, so that it shines through this wing case. And then what I'll do is once I've dubbed the thorax, I'll use CDC barbs in a split thread application, and I'll make a sort of a soft hackle with those CDC barbs. And what I like about CDC is it's highly mobile, but it's also not heavy from a visual perspective. You know, most people like over hackle flies and like make 10 hackle wraps there for the legs. But if you look at the damselfly nymph, it's got 6 legs. It's very dainty, you know, so you lose the whole effect by going balls to the wall on the hackle. So less is more. You don't need much. A couple of CDC barbs in there, perfect. And then you basically pull over the Swiss straw, tie it in. And then I make eyes from melted mono. Typically
Before you
used,
go, Gordon, before you move
yes?
on to the eyes, can you explain the split thread technique you use?
Okay, so the split thread technique basically is you use a thread that lies flat, okay? So I typically use something like Griffith shear or Danville's flat unwaxed or something like that. I'll make sure that the thread is totally flat, okay, so it's not twisted up. And I'll take a needle. I'll first put the thread over my fingernail, and that will basically accentuate the flatness of the thread. And then I'll take a dubbing needle and I'll just separate or split the thread. And then I would have already prepared my CDC. I'll pop it in there and trap it between the split and the thread. Okay, and then I'll basically twist it up, basically like a dubbing brush. I'll twist it up, and it'll create this bottle brush effect. And then I'll basically brush the barbs back and then wrap, you know, like you do when you're folding hackle on a soft hackle or something like that. So that's basically that. Now I know it's hard to follow it when I'm speaking about it, but if you look in the
Right.
book, it's easy to follow because it's visual. You can see what I'm talking about, you know.
We have a question come in from DB in Bozeman, Montana. He says, "What's your opinion regarding split thread versus dubbing loop techniques for placing materials?"
Well, it depends on the fly, and it depends on the material, and it depends on the application. For instance, if you're making a light CDC hackle, I would just split the thread. But certain materials are more robust, and your dubbing loop would be better. So I could say now I was making a deer hair collar, okay? So I'm making a deer hair hackle. So in the same way, I'd do the same thing, except I'd use a dubbing loop. I'd use a loop, a soft loop,
Okay.
and I'd then put the deer hair in the loop, and then I'd twist that up. Why? Because it would be stronger than splitting the thread. Why? Because deer hair is more robust than CDC. So the
Sure.
technique used is dependent on the material and the application. You know, there's not any one technique that fits everything.
Right.
It's all contextual. So you basically have to use the technique that works with the material you're using.
Yeah, no, that makes total sense. Yeah, I mean, deer hair is way more coarse and rough and different to work with than like CDC, which is, like you say, very delicate. So yeah, good. So yeah, you were going to talk about the eyes when I interrupted
so,
you.
Okay. Yeah, so for the eyes, I use the monofilaments, and I normally use Maxima Ultra Green. And I put them in my hackle pliers, and I burn this piece of mono on either side to create the eyes. It's important that you hold it at a 45-degree angle, and it's important that your hackle plier is slap bang in the middle of that little mono strand, and it's not a long strand. It's not long at all. Maybe a centimeter, maybe. And you'll basically create a sort of a mono bath chain, in a sense, okay? And then I'll tie that on with a figure of eight, and I'll put a little drop of super glue in there just to secure it, and then I'll dab around the mono eyes. But normally when people dab around, like, bath chain eyes or something like that, they figure of eight their dubbing wraps. But if you look at a damselfly nymph or a dragonfly nymph, you'll see the heads are fairly flat. So what I'll do with this damsel is I'll dub around individual eyes, only crossing my thread to get to the opposite eye. And then by doing that, you'll create a very flat head profile, okay? And then what I'll do is my thread will be right behind my hook eye. I'll bring over the remaining bit of Swiss straw, tie it down, make a half hitch so that the Swiss straw doesn't slip. Cut it, whip finish, cut off, done.
And you are also, I believe you're using like super glue for cement or head cement or none at all? What are you used for the...
Well, okay, so this is the thing. So what I like to do, especially when I'm tying nymphs, I don't really do this with dry flies, but with nymphs I like to do the following. I take a drop of super glue, I put it on my thread, and I whip finish with the super glue on the thread, okay? You've got to work quickly, because if you work slowly, the stuff dries on you. Or you could also use a super glue that dries slower. And what you then get is what you call an impregnated whip finish. So It's not just varnish on the outside of the head of the fly. It's actually inside the fibers, the thread fibers. It gives you a way more durable head. I'm not one of these people who makes massive thread heads for the sake of making a head on a fly. You know, like on this damsel, I don't even create a thread head. I just whip finish, done.
Yeah, it makes sense to keep it simple and to keep it lightweight and, not using any more material than you have to.
Yeah. I mean, it's like most people, if you look at a lot of these videos, most people use way too much thread. You know, they'll use like 15 thread wraps to tie in a wing, like an elk wing. Mm-hmm. Why? You need like four max, you know. So small things make a big difference. My father-in-law has this saying, you know, spare a match, buy a farm. And basically what that means is that small things have larger implications and make a big difference if you do those small things all the time or make those small savings. And the same thing can be said for fly tying, you know. Yeah.
I've got a bunch of questions that came in here on the internet, so I'm going to kind of roll through these. They may jump around, but Dick in Northbrook, I believe that's Northbrook, Illinois, says he's just thanking you for writing the mechanic books. He thinks they're great.
Nothing.
Yeah. DB in Bozeman wants to know what your background is. Schooling, major in college, was it theater?
So it's theater. So I am a professional actor, and that's what I majored in. I was in this choir school. I've always been a creative person. I've never been conventional. I've never had a conventional day job. Theater. So I majored in theater, and a lot of the work I did as an actor and that I do as an actor is educational. So educational theater, industrial theater, corporate theater, Nowadays, I shoot a lot of commercials. I've done some work on American TV, believe it or not. American Monsters is this series. Have you seen it? About these serial killers.
So
on the Crime Channel, you get this program called American Monsters. And I played one of the characters in the series.
Oh, I'll have to look
for it. I think it was season 2, ep 7 or something of American Monsters. And then I was in this other thing for the History Channel. There were these documentaries shot about the U.S. presidents, Theodore Roosevelt, Lincoln, and they were on history. So, you know, I've done a bit of international work too. But ultimately, I'm a communicator and I'm a teacher. And my acting has helped me to communicate more effectively in terms of teaching people how to tie.
Yeah, well, definitely are very talented in a number of areas. I haven't heard you sing yet, but I imagine you sing rather well. But carries over into your drawing, your fly tying, your fly fishing, all those kinds of things. Another question, what resources are available in South Africa for the fly tire? Do you have access to fly shops, you know, materials? And is that a issue for you, or is it readily available?
It's not an issue for us, but a lot of our materials get imported from the US or from the UK or from other parts of the globe. So things that are easy for you to get might be hard for us to get sometimes, like hackle. Like getting good genetic hackle can be problematic. And we don't have the wide variety you guys have. You basically, there's one distributor in South Africa who brings in hackle, and that's the only distributor who does it. So in America, like, our hackle stock is the equivalent of one fly shop.
Oh, wow. Wow.
It's like, if you look at House of Hackle, you know Jim's House of Hackle? If you look at House of Hackle, our distributor has probably a tenth of the hackle he has, and that's got to cater for the whole of South Africa.
Yeah, yeah. And I imagine it's probably more expensive as well because of the importing and that kind of thing. Yeah. Well, same thing with, like, same thing with rods, reels, line, that kind of thing. Are there South African manufacturers?
Look, we do have South African manufacturers, but what's also important to note is that building your own rods are about the same price as importing or as in buying a shop-built rod, and then you can build it the way you want to, you know. You can. I'll give an example. I've never understood why they varnish rods for small streams, because rod flash is a definite problem, you know. I have seen fish flee because of the sun hitting the rod and there being a flash. So, like, Scott in the old days used to have these very, like, dull blanks. Now, if you build your own rods, you can sand them down, or you don't need to varnish the blanks, you know, and you can custom make it to your specifications. You can even paint the blanks, you know, to dull them down. And that would then change the action slightly, make them slightly softer, because you're adding a little bit more weight to the blank. So South Africans are very versatile people, and we use what we have, and we use it very effectively and efficiently.
Yeah, and I think there was a question about glue or cement. You basically answered that one, I think, for DB.
I'll tell you. I also use Sally Hansen's Hard as Nails sometimes.
Okay.
I'm not a fan of UV glue. Now, I know that might sound weird, but, you know, I once did a very stupid thing. I put some UV glue on my hand, and I put the torch on it, and it burned me. And after that, I just thought, this stuff's dangerous, man. You know, and I know everyone loves UV glue, and I mean, you literally see the fumes
when you nuke it with your torch. You literally see the fumes coming off it. Like, I don't know, hey, like, call me a traditionalist if you must, but like, I don't want fumes coming off my head cement.
I tell you, my dentist sure likes using UV materials. You know, they're using that to do fillings and caps and everything nowadays, you know. Yeah, it's pretty incredible. But yeah, I hear you. Yeah, whatever works, right? DB also asked, do you have particular go-to fly tying materials, threads that you like, you know, across the board for your tying? And I think in your book you mentioned you liked kind of kept it to like three threads or something like that. Huh?
Yeah, that's it. Okay, look, mostly I'm mostly tying for small stream fishing. So I use Unitrico 17-aught for really small stuff. I use Griffith Shear 14-aught for my general stuff. And occasionally I'll use Danville's 6-aught flat unwaxed. For larger flies, if I'm tying terrestrials, hoppers, you know, bigger flies, that kind of thing. So three spools of thread cover me for what I'm doing, you know. And I don't have a massive selection of materials either, you know. My focus is more on quality than quantity. You get people who've got like a major room with like 5,000 different materials. You don't need it. I mean, think about this carefully. If you go to your tying room, you will find stuff that you haven't used in 10 years. Why do you have it? You haven't used it for 10 years, you know? Fly tiers by nature are hoarders. We hoard. That's what we do.
Yeah.
No, we do.
We are. I am.
No, think
I
about
think
this.
I still
think
have,
about this.
I think I have materials, Gordon, from when I was in junior high school still sitting around here.
You see, that's my whole point. So instead of having 100 packets of really bad CDC, I might have 5 packets of great CDC, fantastic stuff. And quality is the most important thing, because if you want to tie quality flies that perform in an optimal way, you need quality materials. You can't skimp on that. You have to, you know, and don't just follow what people are saying on Facebook or saying in magazines or saying, look at what people who are good fishermen, look at what they are doing and what they are using. You know, there's a reason. Look at don't just follow what the ads tell you about hooks or what, look at what people you admire, good fishermen, you know, look at what they're using, you know, and ask, and there'll be a reason they're using those brands or those things. I mean, hooks, some of my favorite hooks are Hamakatsus. Like, hardly anyone I know uses Hamakatsus. I don't understand why. They're fantastic.
Yeah, really good for salt water. A lot of people use them here for saltwater fishing because
they're
so sharp.
No, freshwater. But freshwater as well. I mean, they've got a whole range of freshwater hooks. I mean, everyone knows the Hamakatsu saltwater hooks, but they've got a whole range of freshwater hooks that are fantastic.
Could you speak for a minute about, you talked in your book about tying smaller flies on larger hooks? Can you address that for a minute?
Yes. Okay, so what's your biggest problem with a very small fly? Your biggest problem is a limited hook gape. You need a hook gape to hook the fish, right? So what you can do is, people think, when you think of fly size, you think of the fly size is determined by the size of the gape, so the distance from the point of the hook to the shank. But that's actually wrong, because the fly size is determined by the length of the shank, not the gape. So we all told a size 16 is a size 16 because of the gape. But what if that size 16 has a very short shank? I mean, it could be the size of a conventional size 18, but with the gape of a 16. So what I would typically do if I was tying a small fly, you could tie a small size 20 on a size 18 hook, but with a very short shank, or you could use less of the shank, so you basically undertie the fly on the shank to create a smaller fly on a bigger hook. It's a functional thing.
Yeah, makes sense. And you also, I think, talked about between manufacturers, there can be a significant difference in...
Look, there is a significant difference.
The length of the shank, yeah.
If you look at hook sizes, I mean, look, if you look at brands like Dohiku, Dohiku's hooks are fairly big. So a size 16 Dohiku will actually be like a size 14 Tiemco. You can't just go on what they're telling you. Essentially, the hook you use must match the insect you are tying. So don't worry about sizes. Just look at the hook and say, is that hook the size of the thing I'm tying? And if the answer is yes, go for it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Makes a lot of sense.
So what I'm saying is don't pay too much attention to what the packets on the hooks are telling you. Use common sense.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Yeah.
Let me take another quick break here, and we'll be right back and talk more with Gordon about fly tying. So hang tight, folks. We'll be right back. Discover the power of pure Skagit with Olympic Peninsula Skagit Tactics. From delicate soft hackles to hefty steelhead flies, OPST's versatile casting system meets the demands of every angling situation. With Ed Ward's unparalleled Skagit rod design and casting expertise, OPST offers you a quicker route to mastering effective casting techniques, whether battling wind and rain or targeting steelhead trout or smallmouth bass. Trust OPST's innovative rods, lines, and tips to elevate your fishing experience. Join the ranks of skilled anglers who rely on OPST for consistency, proficiency, and a superior fly fishing adventure. Unleash your potential with OPST today. Visit pureskagit.com or call them at 206-858-8476. Again, that's pureskagit.com or call them at 206-858-8476. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Gordon Van Der Spew about the Feather Mechanic. If you'd like to ask Gordon a question, just go to our homepage, fill out that form, send it in. We'll try to get it answered on the show tonight, today. So used to night, Gordon. I think this might be. But we'll probably be doing more of these afternoon and working with more Africans and Europeans, because there's so many good people over there doing great stuff that we'd like to hear about here more often. So in your book, again, you talked about CDC and the differences out there between the CDC that comes out of Spain and the CDC that comes out of the U.S. Can you talk to that and what your experience has been with that?
Okay, so I think you're talking about Coq de León, CDL. In terms of Spain and what comes out of the U.S.
Oh, yeah, so, CDL, I'm sorry. Yeah.
No problem. So in Spain, they call it Gallo de León, okay? And basically, these birds have been bred in a specific region of Spain for like over 500 years. Tom Whiting got hold of some birds and started breeding them in the U.S. But the U.S. product is very different than the Spanish product. For the simple reason is, number one, they're not cultivated in Spain. Number two, they bred in a different way. The Spanish pluck feathers. In the U.S., they kill birds and skin them. Number three, you've got a smaller genetic pool to draw from in the States. So it will affect the barb quality. Now, that said, the whiting product is great in terms of its availability, in terms of versatility, but it is not a patch on the Spanish product. Now, luckily, fish don't care, because they don't. So if you're using Coq de León, whiting Coq de León for tails, fantastic stuff, you know? No problem. There definitely is a difference if you look at the Spanish product. The Spanish product has better markings. is shinier, is straighter, is thinner, is more delicate, is, you actually have to look at those feathers in your hand to see the difference, and the difference jumps out at you. It just does.
Interesting. Yeah. Are there other, and I got that, you know, from reading your book, that we all need to pay more attention to our materials rather than just grabbing a packet of this or that and trying to tie the fly with it, that we really should be inspecting it more carefully. Are there other materials, you know, whether it be feathers or synthetics or anything, that you find that we should be paying more attention to?
Yeah, that really makes definitely. A difference? Definitely. Simple things like everyone ties pheasant tail knots. The quality of pheasant tail center feathers nowadays very often is not good. And I'll tell you why it's not good. It's because they get these birds out of China and they harvest them at too young an age. So what you tend to find is that the barb quality and the barb length is very short. Whereas if you let the birds become a bit older, you get better quality. And so typically the pheasant tail feathers coming out of the UK, where people hunt birds, very often will be better than the stuff you get from China, simply because the birds are a bit older or whatever the case might be. So quality is a major, major, major thing. Also CDC, you know. Wild birds, I tend to find, have better quality CDC than domestic birds. And for various reasons, if you look at the way they are bred, you know, if you're breeding a duck for the meat market, your whole idea is to breed that animal as quick and as fast as possible to make a profit on your investment. Nature doesn't work like that. Nature's not worried about producing a duck in 3 months.
I never heard it put that way.
So you get a better product. So some of the best CDC comes from wild mallards, you know, or wild ducks, and not domesticated animals. So most of the CDC you're buying from shops is from domestic birds, like Petitjean, domestic ducks, Swiss CDC, domestic ducks. They do also have wild CDC, you know, amongst their stock, but most of it is domestic. Some of the best CDC you'll find, there's a guy in Czechoslovakia, his name is David Jedlica. He sells some of the very best wild mallard CDC. Steve Cooper in the UK from Cooks Hill, same story, sells fantastic CDC. So using the best material you can get is like the way to go. And what fly tiers need to do is understand the nature of the materials they are using. Why are these materials effective? You know, look at different types of CDC and ask yourself a question. What are the differences between them? You know, for instance, like Petitjean CDC, the domestic stuff, it's great for split thread work, but it's not great for tying air flies, because the rachises, what some people call the feather stems, are too thick, you know, and it creates bulk at the tying point, and which is not cool. So those little smaller wild mallard CDC feathers are way more effective for things like air flies, for instance.
Sounds like you either need to be a bird hunter or know a bird hunter and make friends.
You don't even need to be the bird hunter. All you need to do is understand the art of catching ducks. You go to your local pond, you take bread, you get them to come close, and you catch that duck, and you pluck it. I've done it 100 times. My children help me. I'm telling you, mallard ducks can be found everywhere. I mean, they can be found in like most countries. You've got mallard ducks at bird ponds, at parks. You could probably get mallard ducks in Central Park, I promise you. You can get CDC in Central Park, I'm convinced.
Yeah. Well, they're all around here, too, in Colorado. I mean, they're all over wherever you go, there's mallards. Yeah. So, yeah, good tip. Now, the question is, how do you hold a duck while you're plucking it? There must be a technique, right?
There is a technique. So what you do is you fold the wings of the bird towards each other, and you basically grab both wings at the same time, okay? You put the dog's legs in between your legs so he can't move, and you just very carefully and softly pluck the feathers out of there. You don't be rough, be very gentle, and off you go. When you hold the bird like that, with, you do the same thing with when they're plucking gallo de leon, coq de leon. They do the exact same thing. They put the bird between the legs. The Spanish actually tie the legs up of the bird. You don't have to do that, but they do it. And then you just pluck the bird. Yeah.
Okay. Well, maybe I'll get my grandson to do that. Sounds like something for him to do. He actually, I'm not kidding. My grandson is an ex. He goes to these, the kids go to these wildlife farms, you know, and he is an excellent duck catcher.
Yeah, get him. So,
I'm going to call upon him to give me some feathers here. So, yeah. So go ahead. You were going to say something?
No, and roadkill is excellent stuff. I mean, really, you never pass up good roadkill. If you see a dead squirrel next to the road, load that corpse and make it happen, let me tell you.
Yeah, that's... again, I read in your book, be careful what you pick up, right? Depending on how fresh roadkill is better. Let's put it that way, right?
Yeah. Definitely.
We're running down on time here, but what advice would you give to experienced fly tiers looking to take their skills to the next level?
What advice I'd give them is to tie things that challenge them. You know, most fly tiers have genres or patterns that they like tying and that they're good at tying. But then they'll have those flies that they don't necessarily enjoy tying, but that push them that to develop. I'll give an example. People are scared of tying, you know, classic salmon flies. They're beautiful. Tying a classic salmon fly will teach you a lot about tying. It will reinvent the way you see tying, you know. Even in terms of normal fly tying, it's a bit like going on an advanced driving course. You know, you don't need advanced driving skill for everyday driving. But once you've done that course, your everyday driving does change. You know, the way you see it changes. So the same thing happens with things like tying traditional wet flies or classic salmon flies or whatever the case might be. They broaden your skill set and they help you to see things in a different way, and they broaden the way you see things, you know. Yeah, I mean, Roger, you can sit there your whole life and tie squirmies and mop flies and pheasant-tail nymphs, and you'll catch enough fish in them and you can do that, right? And you don't need to tie anything else. You could do that. It would be fine. But why do you fly fish? Why do we do this? It's not about catching fish. It's about how we catch fish. That's important to us, you know. That's why we do it with our fly. I mean, if it was just about catching fish, we could get a spinning rod and just catch a lot of fish doing that. No problem.
Yeah. Jar of power bait and you're all set.
There you go, the, you know?
Yeah. I think you told a story in your book about one of your mentors pushed you one day. I think you were tying, correct me if I'm wrong, but like a split wing, a fly with split wings or something, and you were struggling. And but he had kept telling you, just do it again, and do it again. And by the end of the day, you had won it over and moved forward with your skills. And I thought that was that's what you're talking about here, is we need to push ourselves. We may not have somebody else to push us, but to push ourselves as well.
Well, I mean, you know, it experience things, you know. If you've never tied a wet fly, tie one. See what it does for you. You know, you don't have to love them. You don't have to continue tying them, but try it out. You know, why not? You know, experience it. You might learn something.
and you actually definitely will learn something, I can guarantee you. A lot of people look at traditional methods and they sort of, you know, they think they're irrelevant, but they're not irrelevant. You know, history teaches us a lot. You know, looking at the past teaches us a lot. Life is cyclic. This is all moving in circles the whole time, you know. We'll learn a lot about the future by looking at the past. And fly tying is exactly the same, you know. Mm-hmm. There are lots of things that traditional patterns teach us. For instance, tying blobs. Now, a blob, I don't like a blob, but the method you use to tie a blob is exactly the same as folding hackle on a soft hackle. You know, where you fold the hackle back and then you wrap. The same technique is used in blobs. You know, so that old technique of soft hackles, boom, helps you to tie a blob. I mean, who would have
thought? Right. Yeah. But, yeah.
And that's the way that those old methods are transferable. You won't believe it, but they open your eyes to things. You know, nowadays everyone just wants to do everything quick, easy, and fast. You know, we're the McDonald's generation. If we struggle with something, we don't want to do it. It's too hard, you know?
Right.
But I think that we're shortchanging ourselves. We're robbing ourselves of experiencing something really beautiful, you know, and challenging ourselves. There's nothing wrong with being challenged. There's nothing wrong with failing, you know. My son's chess teacher says, you don't lose, you learn. Use every single failure of yours as an opportunity to develop or learn, then it's a positive thing. You know, when people look at failure, they think of it as a negative thing. Failure doesn't have to be negative if you use it in a positive way.
Right. Yeah, fail forward is a term I use. I'm always failing forward, moving forward with what you learn. Yeah, very good. To finish up here, Gordon, I'd like to, because I didn't do this earlier, for people to understand how to get a hold of you and follow you and so forth going forward. I know we've got your first book on the website on our homepage where people can order the book there. Your second book is being reprinted, as you've told me, and will be available sometime in the future. We don't know.
There are some copies available from Fly Life Canada. Life Canada has copies of the second book. The first book, there's still a couple of them available. The Rogue Angler in Oregon has them. Various fly shops in the U.S. have them.
Right.
So if you need books in the States of the second book, The Feather Mechanic 2, those of you have to get out of Canada from Fly Life Canada from a guy named Gary Hankey. I think he's got 50 copies left. He's got 50 copies left. That's what he's got.
Okay.
So yeah.
Now, DB and Bozeman also asked, do you have videos that, you know, maybe work with your books or are independent of your books? Fly tying videos?
So all you have to do is Google The Feather Mechanic and then tick on videos, and all the videos I've ever done are on there. And you can find videos there. On Instagram, I'm always posting things, The Feather Mechanic. So just look under The Feather Mechanic. On Facebook, there's a group called The Feather Mechanics. So, yeah, and you'll find me there.
Okay. And do you have a website where people can follow?
I do have a website, www.thefeathermechanic.com.
And easy to remember.
You know, so I've got videos on there as well. And it's easy to find.
Great. Right. Well, stick with me for a few more minutes because we're gonna give away a copy of your book, Feather Mechanic, the first book. And we're also going to be giving away a one-year membership to Fly Fishers International and a one-year membership to Trout Unlimited. So hang tight. We'll be doing that in just a minute and finish up the show. The Bonefish and Tarpon Trust works very hard to safeguard the future of our beloved flats fisheries, from protecting spawning sites threatened by unsustainable fishing pressure to securing historic funding to restore Florida's Everglades and estuaries. Thanks to their members, they've expanded their conservation to the Bahamas, Belize, and Mexico. There's still much more work to be done, and they need your help. With your support, they can ensure that the flats fishery is healthy and sustainable now and for generations to come. Visit btt.org and become a member of the Bonefish and Tarpon Trust today. Again, that's btt.org. Just a quick reminder to everyone before you leave the website today, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find a link on our homepage in the section under tonight's show that says, what did you think of this show? Just click on that link and leave your comments. We'd really appreciate it. So now it's time to give away a few prizes here. If you are selected from this show's registration database, you'll be a winner. But if you didn't register for today's show, it's too late now. You'll have to wait till the next show and try again then. But if you are one of the lucky winners, we'll contact you after the show and collect the information so that we can deliver your prize to you. So the first thing we'll be giving away is a one-year membership to Fly Fishers International. To learn more about FFI, go to flyfishersinternational.org. And our winner for that is Don Bishop. Don, I know you're listening. You may already have a membership, but we can talk about that later. But you are the winner of the Fly Fishers International membership. And if you're not familiar with them, go to flyfishersinternational.org, flyfishersinternational.org, and check them out. Our next prize we're going to give away is a one-year membership to Trout Unlimited. And our winner for that is Stan Takami in Illinois. So congratulations, Don and Stan, on winning those memberships, and I know you're going to enjoy them. Now we're going to give away a copy of Gordon's book, The Feather Mechanic. I know after today's show, there's a lot of people who want to win this book, so I need to clear my queue. And what you want to do is I'm going to ask a question. You answer it in that form on our homepage. I just have to, Gordon, I just, one of our listeners just wrote it. He says, so does that mean you have a bunch of naked ducks running around? We have wood ducks in the park up here. So, don't go all out with the plucking, I guess. Okay. Gordon, you still with us? Yeah, we may have lost Gordon. Okay. He may come back on here. Is the domino effect one of the preferred practices, or is it not a preferred practice, as Gordon had talked about it? Okay, domino effect, preferred or not preferred practice for tying flies. All right, let's see what we get here. And okay, let's see, we're starting to get some. Okay, Treg, preferred? The domino effect. No, Treg, wrong. No, the domino effect is not a preferred method of tying. Oh, okay, so Treg, now it's not, 50-50 chance, right? Treg, for all of you, the domino effect was when you keep doing stuff, when you're tying and compounding the errors, which creates a domino effect, putting a couple more turns on, putting more glue on, two more wraps of hackle when you only needed, three out of five or whatever. So it's not a preferred way to go, the domino effect. All right, Treg, longtime listener, you're going to get that book from, are you, Gordon, you back?
I'm back.
Okay. Well, we just gave away your book to Treg Owings in Idaho, I think Treg is. Let's see, Treg, you're in Idaho? Moscow, Idaho, okay. So I will, Treg, send me your mailing address, and so we can get that book shipped out to you, Gordon's book, The Feather Mechanics. The question I asked, Gordon, just for your info, was the domino effect a preferred or not preferred method of tying flies? And so that took him a couple tries to get it. It was a 50-50 shot, but we did get the right answer anyway. So not preferred a way of tying flies. Anyway, hey, Gordon, thank you so much for staying up late there and being on my show. I really appreciate it. It was so fascinating to talk to you, and I hope we can do it again sometime. Oh, one more thing, Gordon. You said you're coming out with another book. Is that something you are willing to talk about, or is that under wraps still?
No, well, okay, so I've started writing it. I'm halfway through.
Okay.
It's the third book, and there was this Russian actor named Stanislavski, and he wrote a book about acting, but he wrote three books, and all the three books work together. So the last book is more about fishing than it is about fly tying, but it's all about application, you know, and
okay.
thinking of fishing in a logical way as well, you know. Very often we just do the same things over and over again because that's the way we've done them. But how about thinking about what we're doing and changing things and trying other things out? And then, for instance, like in South Africa, in stillwater fishing, people are always, and I don't know if this is like an international thing, but people are always moving their flies. But static nymphing in still waters is a very effective way of catching fish.
Yep, just like you were talking about with the damsels. Yeah.
So I write about my experiences, like figuring things out in terms of the fishing. I'm not the best fisherman on earth. I'm definitely not. But I like to think of myself as a thinking angler and a thinking tire, you know.
Right.
Yeah, and the last book's about that.
Perfect. Well, we'll look forward to seeing that when you get that done and looking at all your incredible drawings again, which I love to look at. So again, thanks so much for being on, and hopefully we can talk again soon.
Roger, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, sir. Our next broadcast will be on July 17th, 7 p.m. Mountain Time, 9 p.m. Eastern Time. On that show, we're going to interview Devin Olson. Devin is well known for his innovative river and stream techniques and reveals his stillwater competition and lock style strategies from his travels around the world. So discover how to elevate your fishing game with these proven competition-inspired tactics that you can apply to your local still waters. Don't miss this chance to learn from one of the best and transform your fishing effectiveness. And if you want to, be sure to add this upcoming show to your calendar. Click the Add to Calendar below Devin's picture on our homepage and add it to your calendar. You're all set. I do realize on that homepage it's saying 2 o'clock for that show upcoming, but the calendar is correct, and we'll get that other notice corrected. I'd like to thank Fly Fishers International, Trout Unlimited, the Bonefish and Tarpon Trust, Olympic Peninsula Skagit Tactics, Ugly Bug Fly Shop, and Enrico Puglisi Flies for sponsoring our show tonight. Don't forget to visit our website at askaboutflyfishing.com and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good day, everyone, and good fishing.